Well, we're in an area that's a shrub scrub wetland. It would be a drier end wetland in that, as you can see, we have no water standing on the surface. But if we went off to the side...
It's almost dusk at the Jackson-Fraser wetland on the edge of Corvallis, Oregon. Birds sit on branches of nearby trees singing quietly while dry leaves crunch underfoot as Mary Cantula walks down a long boardwalk sitting just above the land. It's a favorite place for Cantula. That's because she doesn't just study wetlands. She loves them. These scrubby bushes and mucky soil speak to her. They touch her soul.
I think they're beautiful, and they're different than other places on the landscape. And I've come to really like the variety, all of the different flavors that are out there. It's an area where I can just lay down and take a deep breath and don't care if I'm getting wet or muddy or anything, just kind of sink into the area and enjoy the smells and the quiet and the variety.
It's not the reaction some people may have to a wetland such as this one. But Cantula says anyone who takes the time to get to know a wetlands will begin to understand. Wetlands appeal to Cantula from the head as well. As a scientist, she also loves wetlands because they're so unique.
They're not aquatic, and they're not terrestrial. They're in between. And if you look at all the types of wetlands that are out there, they run from those that are dry, that are more terrestrial, to those that are very wet, that are more aquatic. And because they're in this unique position, not quite aquatic, not quite terrestrial, they have a special role. They have a whole set of special functions they perform. They have a whole set of special plants and animals that live there, that live nowhere else. Plus, the animals from the truly aquatic and the animals from the truly terrestrial use that area because of these unique characteristics. So, something like 90% of the world's endangered species are dependent in some way on wetlands because it's such a unique area. It offers such special characteristics, types of habitat, the availability of food, the fact that there'll be water in these systems when the uplands are dry. So it makes them special on the landscape.
Wetlands are special in part because of what they provide, not just for animals, but for humans. They offer what economists refer to as natural services. That means they provide many benefits to humans and the natural world. To better describe these benefits, scientists often refer to wetlands as nature's kidneys. Just as our kidneys serve to remove wastes and poisons in our blood, wetlands provide similar services to the rest of nature by trapping sediments and breaking down excess nutrients and contaminants in our water. They also store floodwaters and provide homes for important fish species. Wetlands provide recreational opportunities like bird watching, fishing, and canoeing, and they increase our water supplies by storing surface water and recharging our aquifer. For all these reasons, Cantula's work has taken on a sense of urgency. That's because every day, more and more wetlands are lost. Development's a major reason, but some wetlands are drained for agricultural uses as well. The federal government recognized the need to protect the nation's remaining wetlands in the 1980s when the first President Bush established a policy that became known as No Net Loss of Wetlands. Under certain conditions, wetlands could now be developed, but any wetlands lost must be replaced through a process called mitigation. Mitigation, very simply, is compensation. Compensating for filling or destroying of wetlands. And the way to do that is either create a new wetlands or do something to improve an already existing wetland. Mitigation can happen in a number of ways.
The four typical types of mitigation are wetland creation, restoration, enhancement, and preservation. And creation and restoration are the ones that are preferred and more most commonly, because creation, you're basically making a wetland in an area that wasn't a wetland. So if you lost an acre of wetland, you make an acre of wetland somewhere else. The problem with that is that it's very difficult to do because you don't necessarily have the water, the hydrology that's needed to establish the wetland. Restoration is more common, and in that case, you go into a degraded site and try to improve its ecological quality. And so we get something back for that loss because we're improving the quality of a site. Enhancement is the case where you go into a wetland, often a degraded wetland, and try to improve a particular function or set of functions. So, for instance, you might improve its habitat value for an endangered species. The downside of enhancement is that when you increase or change a site to enhance or improve one particular function, you often do it at the expense of another. So there's a balancing that's going in there, and you're trading one thing for another. And the last one is preservation. And you do have the promise that a site that's probably valued in good condition would not be developed. But again, that promise is made in exchange for losing a site. So it is a net loss in wetland area.
No two wetlands are the same, but one thing they all share is their complexity. And because of this complexity, it's difficult and expensive to restore or enhance a wetland. So mitigation has more likely than not meant wetlands creation instead. And the only type of wetlands that's fairly easy and inexpensive to create is a pond.
Because one can go out and dig a hole in the ground, put in a clay layer to seal the bottom, and then it'll collect water. Other wetlands that are groundwater fed or on the floodplain are much more difficult to create because you have to have, for instance, in the case of a riverine wetland, you've got to have, you know, your stream or your river. And so you just can't go out in the upland anywhere that is convenient and create a river or stream. So it's harder to do a riverine wetland, or even harder yet, to create a wetland that's supported by groundwater, that you need to find out a way to bring that groundwater to the surface. So that's what makes creation so difficult, is that you can't get the full suite of wetland types going off into the upland because you can't get the full suite of different types of hydrology.
So today, when mitigation occurs, there are many complex functioning wetlands being replaced somewhere else by open water ponds with an entirely different set of functions, and often with a new set of problems. For instance, a temporary or seasonal wetland will dry up during some times of the year. That means amphibians living there must have a short life cycle, reaching maturity before the water dries up. But in open water systems such as ponds, entirely different species can dominate, and not all of them are desirable.
For instance, the bullfrog, which is native to eastern United States, was introduced here. It's an exotic species, and it's a voracious predator, and it actually, you know, will eat the naturally occurring amphibians and reptiles, pond turtles, and even ducklings. And the populations of bullfrogs have really grown in this area because we have this increased amount of permanent open water.
Bullfrogs can dominate in these systems because the ponds provide a constant source of water. The life cycle of the bullfrog requires constant water for 2 years, so they cannot survive in temporary or seasonal wetlands. But they love the open water found in many created wetlands. The bullfrogs are just one example of the problems mitigation can cause.
We're doing better in terms of area, but we're not doing very well in terms of function, that we're trading one set of wetlands with one particular characteristic group of functions for another set that has a different set of functions. And then that has impacts in areas like the decline in flood storage capacity that we were able to document in the Portland area.
And that's where Kintula's current work comes in. The EPA has established a goal to conduct a wetland survey in 2011. That effort is part of a larger goal to provide nationally consistent reporting on the condition of the nation's waters. Besides generating a report card on our aquatic resources, These surveys will be used to set national and regional water quality priorities and identify research needs. When repeated over time, the surveys will also allow EPA to determine how well regulations and management practices are working to maintain and improve the quality of our wetlands and other aquatic resources. The hope is that when the initial work is done, scientists will for the first time have a complete survey of the ecological condition of the nation's wetlands. This is important because despite the value of wetlands, there's never been a national assessment of their quality. A national wetlands health checkup.
Typically, your doctors, when you're in your mid-30s, want to have to give you an extensive test when you take a physical so that they have a baseline for as you age. You know, what were you kind of at your prime? And it's the same sort of thing, except our wetland resource isn't necessarily at its prime right now, but we're here now, so we want to know where we're at now and which way is the trajectory going. Is it up or down?
Kintula is developing a layered methodology for the survey. Because of the scope of the project, it would cost too much and take too long to conduct a comprehensive evaluation of every possible wetland. So the survey will begin with a landscape assessment. This level one assessment, as it's called, will be relatively inexpensive. That's because it will not require researchers to go out into the field. Instead, it will use already available data and couple that data with a geographic information system, or GIS.
Basically, it'd be a computer analysis. And one of the indicators that are commonly used looking at the condition of wetlands is land use. What's going on in the vicinity of the wetland? Are there changes in the land use? Are the wetlands built up right to the edge, or is there a buffer of upland between the wetland and any development? So those are the kinds of things one can look at with this mappable data. Or, for instance, you could also pull stuff from satellite pictures and look at whether the sites are wet when you'd expect them from aerial photography.
The next level, level two, is sort of a SWAT team approach, quick in and quick out. They are calling the method a rapid assessment. It will require that a team of two people spend half a day in the field looking at the wetland to conduct the assessment.
And that's why it's called rapid. And a lot of times it will focus on stressors, because in order to go out and do something more comprehensive, you often have to identify the vegetation and dig holes and do things that take you all day. Where with a rapid assessment, what you can do rapidly is walk the site and look for things that are going wrong. Is it ditched? Do you see weirs, water control structures? Has the site been harvested, the trees cut down, with somebody in there digging or moving around earth? And so a lot of the rapid assessments look for those types of features, changes to the morphology, harvesting of the vegetation. It'll also look for evidence of exotic species.
The final level, level three, is the one they'll use the most on the national assessment. That's because it's the most comprehensive,
where you go out and you take quantitative measurements. And we're talking usually about a six-person team, a whole day, a very long day on the site doing all these varieties of measurements. And the difference in these assessments is that a level one assessment with a landscape assessment can give you a quick snapshot about what's going on. And very often you find out that you're generally correct but specifically wrong, because when you get to the site, you can find out there were things you didn't see with the aerial photography, the digital map data that you have.
You can just imagine how large a project this will be. Thousands of acres in every state of the country will be evaluated. Researchers at all levels will be involved. Local, state, federal workers, and perhaps even some volunteers will help. The whole process will take a lot of time, in part because there's so many questions to be answered.
What is the condition of the wetland resource? What are the primary stressors? Where do they occur? What extent of the resource is influenced by those stressors? What extent of the resource is in good condition? And where is our resource in the best condition?
But the benefit, says Kintula, will be immense. For the first time, researchers will be able to determine what methods work the best to characterize the ecological status of wetlands along with their functions.
Well, the first time we do it, What we'll be providing primarily is a baseline. We will be saying, okay, this is the status of the resource now. And the value of that information is that with some luck, we'll be able to repeat this every 5 to 7 years and then start asking questions like, all right, we knew we had problems with wetlands in this area, and we put in effect these best management practices, or we did these restorations. Do we see an effect? Do we see an improvement in the condition of the resource given the actions we're taking? So in the case of thinking about EPA and regulation is that I look at it as a way of saying, okay, if we're going to require people to do certain things because we say we're going to make the environment better or perhaps improve the quality of the water, can we prove that what we're prescribing, what we're asking people to do, works? Does it have an effect?
In other words,
if we're going to spend resources, if we're going to ask people to do things, change the way they do business, how they live, maybe even, you know, spend money to manage their lands differently, then I think we need to have a good reason, and we need to show that whatever we asked them to do worked and actually got a benefit.
There's a lot of work remaining for Kintula and her colleagues before the assessment begins. As they move closer to the start date in 2011, they'll be trying to solve one particularly large challenge.
How do we put this all together and do it everywhere across the nation, given all the different regions of the United States and all the different wetland types? So how do we do this so that we can come up with an answer that will be meaningful to the local communities, but also will give information to Congress and the American people overall about the condition of the resource?
But it's a challenge Kintula is looking forward to. After all, wouldn't you do all that you could do to save something you love?
So we have ash trees for coming up, which are along the edges of either the Fraser or the Jackson. We have two creeks that go here, so we have a little bit of a riparian area in here.
For EPA Science in Action, I'm Donna Vincent Roa.
So we actually have three types of wetlands in this area. We have one that we would call flats, which are wet meadows.